From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the WABE studios in Atlanta, Georgia. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
I'm with Catherine Orsborn from Shoulder to Shoulder. Catherine, what's the significance of this interfaith gathering in front of the Supreme Court today?
Well, I think it's critical that there's people out here of all different faiths and backgrounds saying no Muslim ban ever as part of us showing that this affects all of our communities. This case is really critical, not just for how it will affect the Muslim community, but how it affects our American commitment to religious freedom and whether or not we are going to be able to uphold that ideal.
My name is Shannon Lederer. I'm the Director of Immigration Policy for the AFL-CIO.
Tell me, why is this a concern for the AFL-CIO?
Because discrimination in any form is negative for working people in our country and around the world. And we've had union members who were directly affected by the ban. And so we're here to say that this is not reflective of American values or labor values.
And why is it important that we have an interfaith group here this morning in front of the Supreme Court?
For the same reason. Unless we're all united in defending these values, then I think we can see that we're at risk of losing them. So it's going to take all of us to push this back.
On Wednesday morning, activists gathered at the Supreme Court to send a clear message. The so-called Trump Muslim ban that the justices were to hear arguments on that day must not stand. On hand was Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline, who spoke with many of those in attendance and who will be with us himself later in this week's show.
Ralph Drollinger founded Capital Ministries with the idea that if you change the hearts of lawmakers, then their Christian worldview will guide them to make good policies.
They are so teachable. Like Jeff Sessions, he'll go out the same day I teach him something, I'll see him do it on camera.
There may be nothing about a fundamentalist Christian Bible study leader sitting down every week with a number of Republican legislators on Capitol Hill. Maybe him doing that with members of the president's cabinet is okay by you as well. And when this same leader starts sponsoring similar sessions in governments of the former Soviet Union, Africa, and beyond, maybe even that doesn't bother you. But it sure bothers me. And it bothers People for the American Way, senior fellow Peter Montgomery as well. He's written about the political ministry of Ralph Drollinger, and he'll be here with us with details. But first,
it was a controversial and fiery morning in Noonan as about three dozen neo-Nazis met up with more than hundreds of counter-protesters.
Last weekend, a small but shocking Nazi protest in the town of Noonan, Georgia, saw a much larger number of counter-protesters. To date, no White House statement as to whether there were very fine people on both sides, And then the Nazis moved on to Draketown, where a giant flaming swastika lit up the Georgia night. Folks, I'm speaking to you from a radio studio less than 5 miles away from the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church of Atlanta, the pulpit where Martin Luther King Jr. served as co-pastor, the pulpit where Martin Luther King Sr. continued to serve as co-pastor until 1975, the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site. It's all less than 5 miles from where I sit. And that giant swastika burned, surrounded by Nazi salute-giving white supremacists and anti-Semites. Friends, it burned barely 40 miles from where I sit right now. One could drive there before the show is over. I'm telling you all of this because just weeks after marking the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King, we are faced yet again with metastasizing racism and hate in the same country that elected and reelected Barack Obama as its president. For thoughts on this almost immeasurable disconnect, I am grateful to welcome to the studio the Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock, who since 2005 has served as senior pastor at the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church. Dr. Warnock, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's always good to be here with you.
On Saturday, those horrible events happened nearby. On Sunday, you stepped into the pulpit where Dr. King had been. What'd you find yourself needing to say?
Well, I just try to be faithful to the gospel every week. You know, the whole nation has been focused these last couple of weeks on the ministry and the martyrdom of Dr. King, who literally gave his life 50 years ago. His life wasn't so much taken as much as he laid it down. In pursuit and with the profound commitment to this wonderful idea we call America, he really was a patriot, and he was a preacher. And he spoke truth to power and insisted that we stand, in his words, by the best, even in an evil time. And so I work every week to be faithful to that. I think that as we've commemorated Dr. King's death, and we even commemorated the funeral on April the 9th, that in a real sense, part of what will help us, Walton, is we need to bury, we need another funeral for Dr. King. We need to bury King the magician that we've created since the real Dr. King died. The work that he did continues. It costs a great deal. And in those last days, out of a profound love for America, he had some very harsh words for America. Exactly 1 year prior to his death, he called America the greatest purveyor of violence on the globe. His move against segregation, move from the Deep South, Birmingham, Memphis, you know, Selma, Atlanta, to Chicago, where he said he saw the face of racism unlike anything he'd ever seen before. And so as this prophet, this American prophet, moved his work from addressing segregation in the South to addressing segregation also in the North, recognizing that it's not a Southern problem, it's an American problem. Mm-hmm. And as he made the connection between our failure to have a war on poverty because we were busy waging war against the brown poor of Vietnam, he became less and less popular, so that by the time they had the last public opinion poll for Dr. King, which was in 1966, two-thirds of Americans had an unfavorable view of Martin Luther King Jr. I submit that the King that we have resurrected, even in many of our public commemorations, is a bit of a far cry from the King who was actually assassinated. But it is that King that we need to hear now more than ever, that King who still calls for the best in us, but speaks clearly and powerfully about this ongoing sin, this original sin, if you will, of racism in America. He'd be speaking to that today. He had planned the Sunday after he was assassinated, he had planned to preach at Ebenezer on Sunday, April 8th, a sermon, hear this, entitled Why America May Go to Hell. Now, those aren't words we expect to hear from Martin King because we've resurrected a certain kind of memory of King, but he spoke challenging words, and I think in a time like this, the country needs voices of faith and moral courage to speak honestly and yet tenderly to a country that desperately needs to heal.
We certainly are familiar with hate and prejudice, but it still doesn't feel good. It's still not good. How does something like this that went on in Noonan and the burning of the cross, how does that impact members of your church?
Well, you know, the sad fact is black people have grown accustomed to negotiating what I call respectable racism. The reality of institutionalized racism is just that. It is pervasive. It is systemic. It is reinforced and calcified at every level of the society. And if you are an African American, if you are a person of color, there's a way in which you navigate that every day, even if you're the president of the United States, as was the case with Barack Obama, having to deal with, you know, so there's a kind of respectable racism, if you will, that black people live with every day. But in this moment, as a result of what we've seen emerge in this climate since 9/11/16, which might be our spiritual 9/11, the emergence of Trumpism has created a kind of unabashed and unembarrassed racism that erupts in the burning of a cross in Noonan or in Charlottesville. You know, these are fires that have had a slow kind of burn and simmer all the time, but we have not seen it. It's usually people on the fringe. We have not seen what we're witnessing in this moment, and we need to take it very seriously.
Tell our listeners what you think the role of the church is in a time like this.
To speak truth to power. If the church doesn't speak, who will? And as someone who comes out of a church whose history is inextricably tied to struggle, and more importantly, as I read the gospel, I just believe that it's the job of God's preacher and God's church to speak truth to power. But if we're honest on this issue of race, more often than not, the American churches have been on the wrong side. The American churches were on the wrong side of slavery. They were on the wrong side of segregation. Dr. King, if you go back and read his letter from a Birmingham jail, over and over again, he says, "I'm disappointed with the church." He said, "As I travel through the South and I see its beautiful churches and its massive educational buildings with its spires pointing heavenward, I ask myself, what kind of people worship there and who is their God?" He came from a kind of justice-making tradition that connected freedom to faith. We call it the black church. It's really the anti-slavery church because we've never been racially exclusive in any sense. But the black church was literally born calling the church to task. It was born fighting for freedom. It was born fighting against slavery. And it has had to be the conscience of the American churches. And it seems like in this moment in which white evangelicals are more responsible than any other singular group in America for the election of Donald Trump, that once again, voices of faith and moral courage across races, across denominations, and I would argue across faith traditions, have got to stand up and remind us of what America represents at its best. E pluribus unum, out of many, one.
We've got to take a quick break now, but I'll talk more with Raphael Warnock in just a minute. Also, Rabbi Jack Moline will bring us his eyewitness impressions from Wednesday's anti-Muslim ban rally at the Supreme Court.
I'm with Rabbi Jason Kimmelman Block. It's important for Jews to be here at the Supreme Court as it rules on the Muslim ban because this is part of the country we're working for and trying to build. We do not want a country where religious minorities or other vulnerable populations are targeted either for banning or in any other way. There were times in our history when it has been us from the government. So for me, this is about not only my neighbors and family members, it's also about my ancestors.
My name is Jihan Hakim. I'm here representing Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus and also representing my community, the Yemeni American community. As you know, a lot of civil rights organizations and civil rights leaders are declaring this policy as anti-Muslim. So as people of faith, I believe that interfaith communities have to speak up for religious freedom, and I applaud them for being here today.
And exporting American political right ideology. We'll hear from Peter Montgomery. I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Getty. My guest is the Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock of the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. There are a lot of people who are saying the white church has abdicated its responsibilities related to race again. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that it's really the responsibility and the calling of those who occupy pulpits of largely white congregations and the members who sit in those pews to ask themselves, how do they want to be remembered? If you are silent in this moment, if you have nothing to say about the fact that the land of the free is the mass incarceration capital of the world, we Americans are 5% of the world's population. We warehouse 25% of the world's prisoners. Most of them are there for nonviolent drug-related offenses. People of color are the overwhelming majority of the persons who are in prison. For 30 years and more, we prosecuted a so-called war on drugs, which was really a war on black and brown bodies. And now that the addicts are white bodies in rural communities and suburban communities, and the drug is meth, we're now talking about a public health emergency. So for 30 years and more, we had a war in places like Baltimore and South Central L.A. and numerous other inner cities and communities across this country. And young black and brown people were called super predators. Our families were once again torn apart as they were during slavery. Communities have been decimated by the actual war. And now we're talking about a public health emergency, yeah, which is a more enlightened way to talk about it. But the question for me is, what are we going to do to make whole the communities that have been torn apart by this war that's been prosecuted all of these decades? All of the families, we who are Christians and who are in the church and talk about family values, what are we going to do to restore those families and make them whole? And so I think this is a moment in which the white church has got to decide. You know, as you look back and think about, say, well, I wasn't there during slavery. I wasn't there during segregation. Well, you're here now. And the question is, are you as invested in white supremacy as were your forebears?
Is there any hope that some of our political leaders who have frankly benefited from looking the other way at best or even providing cover at times— for some of these extremists, is there any hope that they are reachable, whether by religious leaders or by voters?
For me, the question is not whether the politicians are reachable. I think we have to snatch our democracy back. We get the politicians we deserve. The democracy belongs to the people. If we think we can vote and then disappear and that makes us a democratic republic, we are sorely mistaken. And as we're watching what's unfolding now, I think we should know better than we've ever known before that we really have to take a deep investment in our democracy. And I believe in democracy, and I believe it with a kind of moral conviction, because at its root, it's about giving everybody a voice. And we're witnessing the ways in which politicians have literally gerrymandered themselves into irrelevance, because the lines are so drawn that they are incentivized only to play to their base. And that's not going very well for the American citizens. We're no longer picking the politicians are picking us. And Again, voices of faith and moral courage need to stand up and address gerrymandering, address this terrible Supreme Court decision a few years ago, Citizens United, which made corporations people,
yeah.
Address the insane amounts of money in our system. We've got to stand up. Listen, race is an ongoing problem in America, but the truth is, at root, all of us want the same thing. We want our children to go to schools where they can get a good education, an excellent education, so that they can maximize their highest potential. And for us to invest in that as a country is not just the right thing to do, it's enlightened self-interest, particularly as we watch the demographic shifts in our country. The truth of the matter is, in a couple of decades, America will no longer be a majority white nation. And quite frankly, that's part of what's scaring the bejeebus out of some folks.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that rather than give in to those who traffic in fear and hate, we ought to invest in our children. We ought to think about the fact that all of us, you know, you and I are going to need somebody to pay into Social Security and to make sure that the streets are paved and that the hospitals are open. We've got to invest in our children. And over the last few years, over the last few decades, another thing that has happened, it's not just a race thing. It's also a class thing. On both sides of the aisle, politicians very seldom say the word poor anymore. Poor people have been maligned and criminalized. And the Kaiser Family Foundation came out with a study not long ago saying that Christians, more than any other group, are more likely to blame poor people for their poverty. There's something distorted and twisted about our theology that has caused us to forget that poor brownstone Palestinian Jewish preacher who stood up and during his first sermon, he just had someone read from Isaiah that the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to preach good news to the poor. And all I'm hearing out of this administration and is a lot of bad news for poor people. And I think part of what God is going to ask us is, what did you do for the marginalized? What did you do for the poor? The Bible says that the one who gives to the poor lends to the Lord.
Where is our nation right now?
We are in a critical moment of decision. The wonderful thing about a crisis is it confronts you with a decision. And we get to decide what kind of nation we want to be. America has always been a nation of contradictions. We are a wonderful miracle, an amalgamation of cultures and races that have come together. And the only thing that holds us together really is this, is an idea. Our forefathers spoke eloquently about it. Thomas Jefferson, whom Dr. King was fond of quoting, said that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, this has been an ongoing project. Democracy is a work in progress. When Thomas Jefferson uttered those words, he said all men, but clearly he didn't mean all. He, too, was a slave owner. And when he said men, he apparently literally meant men, because it wasn't until the 1920s that women got the right to vote, which is why when I go to Washington, D.C., when I visit the Thomas Jefferson Memorial, I get great comfort in knowing that just on the other side of the River Basin, there's a black man who was the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church standing there with his arms folded as if to say to Thomas Jefferson, did you really mean what you said when you said what you said? It's been a work in progress. And very often it's the people on the margins who help us to understand what this democracy is all about. And so I think that this is a moment, quite honestly, as a post-Civil Rights generation baby, as someone born after Dr. King was assassinated, I stand with kind of on tiptoe anticipation of what we can become, because people in my generation often imagine what we would have done if we lived back then through the 60s. Well, we no longer have to ask that question. The question is not what would we have done. The question is what are we going to do and what kind of nation we intend to be right now.
Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock is senior pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historical Site. Dr. Warnock, President Obama unforgettably quoted William Faulkner, and I quote him now, "The past isn't dead, it isn't even past." You are in the eye of the storm, and it's a political, racial, and spiritual storm. Right. I thank you for your leadership, your vision, and I thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio again.
You're very kind. Thank you so much.
Up next, Peter Montgomery, senior fellow at People for the American Way. And later, the Trump Muslim ban is finally in front of the Supreme Court. Rabbi Jack Moline was at a Wednesday rally and will have a briefing for us.
My name is Mohammed Gula, executive director of MGAGE on the Virginia chapter.
Why is it important that there are people of so many different faiths in front of the Supreme Court today?
I think that it's important because it creates a different narrative of unity, which otherwise is not portrayed, not only in the media, but also in other aspects of just life in general. So a lot of times we hear a lot of stories of how we're not able to come together and work together, and I think that today shows that we are able and willing as well to kind of create a better community.
I'm Brianna Diaz, and I'm legislative counsel for the Human Rights Campaign. It's important that the LGBTQ community is here today because we are Muslim. We are impacted by this travel ban that Trump has imposed on our community. We also, as a member of the civil rights community, oppose any Islamophobia or any form of oppression brought forth by this administration.
If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. It's become a reliable technique for stoking reactionary nationalistic sentiment in many parts of the world. Scott Lively, the World Congress of Families, and other groups bring money, Bibles, and homophobia to poor countries fertile for this kind of proselytizing. Another is Capital Ministries. Peter Montgomery, senior fellow at People for the American Way, recently reported about the international proliferation of this organization, and I am happy to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio. Peter, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks, Weld. I'm always happy to be here.
I think a lot of people aren't going to recognize the name Ralph Drollinger, so who is this guy?
Ralph Drollinger is a guy who runs weekly Bible studies for members of the House and the Senate and in the Trump administration for members of the president's cabinet. He started off in California doing that for the California legislature, and about 10 years ago he moved to Washington, D.C., and he's aggressively expanding sort of both down and out. He is planting he has or is planting these kind of what he calls discipleship Bible studies for public officials in every state capital, and he's aiming for every local government. And on the foreign level, he's aggressively expanding, trying to get something going in all of the world's capitals, basically.
How does someone like this person gain this much influence on Capitol Hill?
Well, he started off in the California legislature, so he had some political contacts there. And then as things happened, when people moved from the state legislature to Congress, he had some friends in Congress, and he was invited to come start Bible studies out here with members of the House. Then a few years later, some of the members who were attending his Heights Bible studies got elected to the Senate. And so he started a Bible study for the Senate. And then when Trump got elected, of course, the religious right had a friend in Mike Pence, and the Trump administration appointed lots of conservative evangelicals to the cabinet, and some of them were friends of Ralph Dollinger's, and so he got invited to do these for the cabinet.
How long has this been going on, Peter?
Well, he's been in Washington for about a decade, starting with the House and then the Senate, and he's been doing his cabinet Bible studies since last spring, but he's been doing this overall for about 20 years, I think, and he publishes a weekly Bible study every week.
So now, what are the international aspects of this?
Well, he has a goal of Christianizing public officials around the world, and he is hiring 10 regional directors. I think he said he's got 8 in place now. They're all men because he doesn't believe that women can teach men, according to the Bible. But he says that he's established new Bible studies in Romania, Ukraine, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, the Republic of Equatorial Guinea, and says he's about to get started in Guatemala, and this year expects more throughout Central and South America and in some more European nations. And he's also working on getting a ministry going in the European Union Parliament, which he thinks will open the door then to many other Western and Eastern European countries. He says that his aim is a missionary sort of aim, and so he targets public officials and tries to convert them to his fundamentalist brand of Christianity, which then comes with the policy agenda that I just talked about. So his goal is to have Bible studies in all the legislatures, which will be a way for him to reach more legislators. And he cites the example of the Apostle Paul, who went on his missionary trips to the capitals of governments and the seats of governments, because if he could convert kings and other high officials, it would be an influence on other people. And that's the model that he says he's following.
What concerns you most about this kind of quote-unquote ministry?
First of all, Ralph Dollinger, you know, suggests that public officials, in order to be putting forth good policies, righteous policies, need to be fundamentalist Christians. And his goal is to convert public officials everywhere to his very conservative brand of Christianity. And along with that comes a policy agenda that he says is mandated by the Bible. And that's right-wing economics and right-wing social policy. So he preaches that God is a capitalist and that environmental regulations prevent people from making as much money as God wants them to. He says that entitlement programs are unbiblical. And so he's you know, that Christian public officials are obligated to support the death penalty, obligated to oppose legal equality for gay and lesbian and people. So there's a whole right-wing policy agenda that comes along with this. And in the U.S., of course, you know, we hold religious pluralism as one of our core values. And so the idea that he thinks that all public officials should be Christianized sort of flies in the face of that as well.
Are there political implications for this kind of networking with countries that all too often seem to have particularly repressive or nationalistic regimes?
Well, I think that he certainly is going to be giving credibility to right-wing politicians who support his policies. And I think that by setting up the premise that right-wing policies have a biblical mandate, he's going to be in some ways strengthening the hand of those folks. And that's one potential downside.
Do you see coordination between this organization and groups like the World Congress of Families or someone like Scott Lively?
Well, there's certainly a lot of coordination among religious right groups that work overseas. But I think that Ralph Dollinger is actually kind of a lone operator. I think he sees himself as having a particularly wise form of ministry, that he's targeting the conversion of public officials and the discipleship of public officials. And he's actually sometimes been critical of other religious right groups for focusing too much on lobbying for specific policies rather than on trying to change the hearts of the public officials themselves. So I'm sure that the kind of members of parliament that, say, Scott Lively visits when he goes overseas are probably overlapping with some of the same kind of folks who will be interested in Capital Ministries Bible studies. So I'm sure there's probably some overlap there, but I think he tends to work mostly with himself.
Peter, back to the nation's capital before we go. What kind of impact does this guy have on our lawmakers?
Well, he's got a regular audience of several dozen members of the House and Senate who attend his studies and who get copies of his written Bible studies. And so he's got an influence in the sense that they look to him as a spiritual leader, as a spiritual guidance, and he uses that access to teach these principles that you know, right-wing economic and social policies are undergirded by the Bible. He also teaches that public officials should never compromise what he sees as biblical absolutes. And so I think in some ways that's encouraging, you know, an even more extreme version of partisanship in Congress by encouraging these folks to not compromise with policies that he says are grounded in biblical mandates. And that can be on everything from tax and economic policy to, equality for LGBT people and the death penalty.
Peter Montgomery is senior fellow at People for the American Way, a keen observer and chronicler of the political religious right. Peter writes often for the Huffington Post, Right Wing Watch, and elsewhere. Peter, as always, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Weldon. I'm always happy to be here, and I appreciate the chance to come on.
Time for one more break, and then activists at the Supreme Court as the justices weigh the Trump Muslim ban.
Congressman Andre Carson, why is it important that this is an interfaith gathering protesting the Muslim ban at the Supreme Court?
Well, it's so critically important when you have Jewish brothers and sisters standing with Muslim brothers and sisters and Christians and Sikhs and secularists saying enough is enough. It shows that we're all interconnected and we're all one people.
Reverend Noel Anderson with Church World Service and the United Church of Christ. We resettle refugees, and the refugee ban came down January 27, 2017, the same day as the Muslim ban. And as faith communities, basically across the board, we believe that we should welcome the immigrant in our midst. We believe that we should love our neighbor. And these type of what I see as discriminatory policies go against our faith tradition.
I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. There have been a number of lower court rulings on the outrageous Trump Muslim ban, a key issue for this president's deliberately divisive campaign. The general trend has been against the ban, although not 100%. This past Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard arguments on the matter, and a diverse group of activists and advocates, many of them faith-inspired, was on hand to call for a decision that's moral and constitutional.
There's students from Columbus, Ohio, who are witnessing a demonstration in front of the Supreme Court. What do you think of what you're looking at, Daniel?
I think it's pretty cool because just to watch people use their freedom of speech.
I think this is really amazing because it gives people a lot of hope for the new generation.
I think it's great for what they're standing for, what they believe in.
I think it's very interesting that these people come together and protest what's going on, and I think it's very important that they do that because they all have rights.
Yes. I like how they're actually trying to stand up and make a point for what they believe is wrong and try to stand up for what they believe is right. You can't get a point across if you don't speak, so I like what they're doing.
I feel like it's really peaceful, and they're doing a good job of saying what they want to be heard and not being violent.
David Inoue with the Japanese American Citizens League.
Why is it important for you to be here with this interfaith group in front of the Supreme Court today?
75 years ago, Japanese Americans, their rights were taken away just as we're looking to take away the rights of Muslims trying to come into this country for no reason other than who they are. The country has since repudiated that, but again, we're down the path to making that same mistake again.
I'm with Sammy Motionberg. She's had a long career as one of the premier social activists in and out of the Jewish community.
This is targeting the Muslim community. In the past, other religious communities, including the Jewish community, including Catholics, other religious communities have been targeted. And if we're not able to stand in solidarity with each other, we will be defeated and divided. So it's critical that the religious community is here in force. It's very gratifying. And we will win.
I'm with Arjun Sethi.
I'm a community activist, civil rights lawyer, and a professor at Georgetown University Law Center.
And what our listeners can't see is that he is also sick.
What is at stake today is equality under the law, the right to freely worship, the right to free speech, and the right to association. And the reason that people of so many different faiths, people of so many different racial ethnic backgrounds have gathered here today is because the Muslim ban is a threat to us all. It is a violation of the Constitution. It's a violation of civil and human rights. And if you attack our Muslim brothers and sisters, you attack us all.
Jason Miller, Franciscan Action Network.
You're here with Catholics for Justice.
Yes.
Why is it important that this is an interfaith group protesting the Muslim ban in front of the Supreme Court?
Well, we're here as a wide variety of Catholic national advocacy organizations. And as people of faith and as Americans, we're standing here to say that we're a nation of immigrants and that all faiths are welcome.
I'm with Rachel Lazar, who's the new executive director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State.
This is a matter of protecting all religions. This is a matter of protecting basic religious freedom and our constitutional guarantee that every religion should be treated the same in America, that no religion gets preferred treatment or disfavored treatment. So it matters to all of us because all of our religious freedom is at stake.
So you're here defending a wall, just not that wall.
Exactly.
Great.
Wall of separation.
Interfaith Alliance President Jack Moline was there and gathered the voices you've heard throughout this week's show. I've asked Jack to share some of his impressions from Wednesday's rally at the Supreme Court.
I will tell you, Welton, that the time in front of the Supreme Court was very uplifting to me as an activist in the interfaith space and in the religious freedom space. I think virtually every faith community was represented in support of the Muslim community. People from really every imaginable faith community, as well as from the unions, from the LGBTQ community, and from activist communities that do not identify with a particular faith. It was like America out there, and I was very glad to be a part of it. It was enormously important that we all came together on this because any time that the Constitution is violated, it takes those people, not just who are affected by the violation, but who are not affected by the violation, to stand up and to be certain that the rule of law in this country and the values that we maintain are preserved. And that's why we were all out there. We were all out there in support of both the Constitution and the people who were affected by this genuinely awful policy. I was a little concerned that the turnout was smaller than I was used to seeing on other issues that we engage in and support. It was more diverse than I remember, but it was smaller. Part of that, I'm sure, is because it was a rainy day, and part of it because there was no outcome that we expected. This was the day for arguments, not decisions. But part of it, I am concerned, is that we are not aware, we're not familiar with the people who are most affected by this ban in the way we are with some of the other issues that we as Interfaith Alliance and we as Americans of compassionate thought like to think we are.
And so it's important for each of us to make sure that we put a face on this issue, that we know Muslims in our communities, that we become familiar with them as people and not as representatives of a tradition or an oppressed cohort. It was the same thing in the civil rights movement, the same thing in the equality movement, that we just need to get to know each other. Consider reaching out to people who need to be enfranchised as part of our American society, like each of us hopes to be. The Muslim ban is a priority for us at Interfaith Alliance, really for two reasons. From an institutional point of view, I have to say that it is it's a priority because it is a constitutional issue. The First Amendment guarantees that government will not establish or disestablish religion or any religion. And when Muslims are singled out for this kind of treatment, it's a clear violation of the First Amendment. We need, as a community, as an organization, to stand against such establishment. For me as a Jew, it's equally important because, after all, if my family had been subjected to this kind of a ban back in the day when Jews were the disfavored minority, I wouldn't be here talking to you today. So it's extremely important for me personally to stand up on behalf of my Muslim brothers and sisters. I imagine people wonder if it was a galvanizing moment for the community. And I'd like to think that it was, because almost everybody who got up to speak spoke in the same terms, that they were not willing to allow the Muslim ban to set a precedent that would be influential on their own sense of security in the United States. And that's something important to remember. We see ourselves as being part of that cohort, of being part of the folks whose safety and security and sense of being fully American was endangered by this ban. Lastly, I wonder about the effect of these rallies and demonstrations. Is the court affected by our presence on the day that they're hearing arguments? Or in a lower court on the day that it is considering a suit like the one that was being heard by the Supreme Court today? I think the answer to that is I hope not. And I hope not because the judiciary has to be independent. It has to be fair. It has to make these decisions on the basis of the law. But the importance of us being in front of the Supreme Court this week, the importance of us being present when these cases are heard in districts or in localities, is that America has to understand that there is a preferred outcome to this, that we believe that the law itself protects those who are vulnerable, not those who are privileged, and that the fairness of the Constitution is on trial every time a constitutional question like this is considered. And so I was very pleased to be there, very proud to be there, and it's my hope that we will have fewer such demonstrations in the future, but if they happen, you can bet you that Interfaith Alliance is going to be there amplifying your voice and the voices of all people who believe in the inviolability of the First Amendment.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That state of belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.